I think the kind of transnationalism that is common today is basically impossible without fiat. I don't think there's a historical precedent for it. And that alone ought to worry you, provided you already buy that the toxic bigness that emerges from fiat is unnatural. I think it doesn't necessarily mean that transnationalism is bad, but it ought to at the very least make you suspicious that, you know, why is this only really emerged now or very recently in historical terms?
You're listening to the Wake Up Podcast with Alex Fetsky, the place where the most dynamic thinkers and practitioners in the world drop truth bombs and contrarian viewpoints to help you become the best version of yourself. Find us on the Fountain app and send us a boost with a comment. Mr. Alan Farrington, the Scottish squirrel himself, joins me for the Bitcoin is Venice series. He needs little introduction for my audience, but if you've not heard of him, you should check out his writing. Hands down, one of the best writers in Bitcoin. Eloquent, witty, and razor sharp. He's part of the crew whose writing got the attention of Peterson, actually. He wrote The Separation of Money and State for the fourth edition of the Bitcoin Times. In this episode, we look at that piece alongside a discussion that meanders in all sorts of directions. I want to thank Unchained Capital and Blockware Solutions for helping support the Bitcoin Times and ensuring that it stays free for everyone online. If you're interested in proper self-custody or stacking some KYC-free sats via mining, you can learn more about each of them in the links in the show notes. Finally, remember to follow Alan's work on Twitter. He's at AlanF32 and subscribe to the Wake Up Podcast. Enjoy the show.
You look like you've walked off the set of what's the goddamn movie with William Wallace again? For fuck's sake. Braveheart. Jesus, it's Braveheart. My favorite movie and I forgot the name. How does it feel to be on the set of Braveheart 2? Wait a minute. It would be number 3.
I don't think there can be a Braveheart 2. I don't know if you know the history that is very loosely based on.
Yeah, well, I mean, partially. I know he
did. I know what it, maybe you're, like your listeners might not have seen it, so I don't want there to be spoilers, but there can't be a 2.
Well, they actually made a 2. They did it about Robert the Bruce. Well, they basically, the story continues with Robert the Bruce and basically him, finishing off the, William's.
Achieving basically nothing in a historical context.
Well, can you enlighten us on that a little bit? I know this
not
is
really.
Complete.
I just find it funny because this is useless, like, Scotsman, this is the sort of the go-to vaguely militaristic national lore, but they sort of conveniently skip over that this all happened in the 1300s, and you're like, right, well, what happened in the next 400 years until the next thing that they actually teach you about in terms of Scottish history? And there's it's just nothing. Don't worry about it.
Really?
We won this one battle, okay? It's what the national anthem is based on. Be proud. They made a good movie about it, and they got an Australian to play the hero.
I still think it's the greatest movie ever made. For me, seriously, that movie, I think.
Is it like, is it because of the Australian connection? Is that like, is it your favorite Mel Gibson movie?
Hell no. It's got nothing to do with that. I think for me, I think it ingrained from a young age, the value of freedom more than anything else.
Just because he shouts it a lot.
Well, he shouts it a lot, but it's also just the premise of the goddamn movie is the idea that some, group of monkeys by decree want to, force another group, to do shit that they don't want to do. And then, against all odds, this army rises up, it does something about it. So, I know you like to take the piss out of everything, but I actually think
in this case.
Yeah, exactly. But I actually genuinely think they don't, number one, they don't make movies like that anymore, obviously. And number two, it's the premise of the story, like all great stories about a hero, have something to do with some form of liberation. And this is, I guess, just your example. I just think it was most beautifully depicted in that specific movie, I'm sure.
I think we probably have different reactions to it because I grew up with it as a kind of I'm not sure how to describe it exactly. It was highly relevant in the culture because I think I was like 3 or something when it came out. But it was also known to be wildly inaccurate and unnecessarily kind of stoking nationalism in a way that was kind of incongruous because it didn't really make sense. So it was anachronistic the way they were doing it, but it was like hyper anachronistic given it was clearly supposed to make you feel a certain way in Scotland in the late 90s. So I my reflection of it is kind of unintentionally comical, I think, whereas I imagine this is lost on you.
Yeah, totally lost on me. What was... This is a total fucking tangent to the goddamn podcast. But what was inaccurate about it? Yeah, it is going to be on the podcast. Oh, sweet. Fuck it. People can listen to it. What was inaccurate about it? Just out of curiosity.
Oh, it's just lots of little things. I don't think they actually did that much wrong in terms of like the grand sweep of William Wallace's life. There was one thing which is kind of annoying, which is that I forget the names of them, but they mixed up two battles. And I mean, not that that's a big deal, but it's particularly unfortunate because the one that they didn't show, which is the Battle of Stirling, is actually really interesting in terms of military history. So it was an underdog victory that was very clever on the part of the Scottish, but they just like cut that entirely. And instead they had the thing with the...
wasn't it?
I don't know how well you remember it, but like with the kilts and the mooning and like, and I might get in trouble for saying this. I'm pretty sure kilts didn't even exist then. So that's the kind of thing I mean, that it's like,
oh, wow.
A kilt is obviously probably the foremost symbol of Scottish national. I mean, other than what, I don't know, bagpipes and haggis, maybe whiskey, I guess. I don't think they could have really put whiskey or haggis into this. There probably were bagpipes, actually. I don't remember the film all that well. But anyway, yeah, it's things like that. It's like, this just didn't like these little details didn't happen. It's not like none of the events at all happened. And the way they portrayed some of the English characters is just like the real people. We know enough about the real people that we know they weren't like that. And they just made them look stupid and effeminate and whatever else.
Was Edward the Longshanks a real prick?
I don't remember enough to comment on that specifically, but I do remember, well, this is weird though, because this is more like me remembering things about the movie than actually remembering the movie. He was characterized in a way that was like hilariously inaccurate. And basically the point of it was to just make you hate the English.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. Well,
I don't, because I'm very tolerant. Bitcoin apparently is inclusive.
Yes, very, very. That beard of yours says otherwise, so I'm sorry. It's very toxic of you.
Do you want to know, just while we're on the podcast, right? I keep forgetting we are actually recording this. It doesn't feel like we should be. Do you want to know why I have this ridiculous beard and why I'm getting rid of it soon?
Tell me.
It ties very nicely with, maybe not with Braveheart exactly, but with a lot of the things we have talked about. So I got married very recently. And it was actually the second wedding, but to the same person, to be clear. We had a sneaky secret wedding in Scotland. It was like the legal one. But then
that sounds like from Braveheart. There we go.
it is a little bit. Well, but then the next part doesn't make any sense at all. We had the real one, the celebratory one, the kind of over the top debaucherous one in Bulgaria. Mm-hmm. Because my wife is Bulgarian, not because we're cheap. But that is also a good reason to have a wedding in Bulgaria if you do happen to be cheap. And so we want to try to make them feel as different as possible so that like the one that was the big party wasn't ruined. Mm-hmm. Or, not that it'd be ruined, but like, you know, didn't feel pointless. And so the vibe of the Scottish one was just very small. It was quaint. It was, you know, I just wore a suit and tie. It was very kind of, we encouraged everyone to not be like super casual, but I think we actually probably said, you know, business casual is the dress code for this wedding. And then my wife had a very kind of elegant, subtle dress. And then for the party one, it was like completely over the top. So she had this like insane princess dress, and me and all my groomsmen were in full black tie kilt. And so part of that as well was that I got a haircut and a beard trim for the previous one, 'cause I was like smart. But then this one, it's like Harry Scotsman. So that's why this is. See how I linked all that together?
That makes a lot of sense.
With historical inaccuracies. That was all true.
It's all very Scottish. Like, even, I mean, I love that you did a secret wedding in Scotland, like to avoid prima nocta and stuff like that. That's very, very noble of you. Anyways, speaking of toxicity, the first, so we want to, I guess the original premise of this podcast was to go through the article that you wrote for Bitcoin Times edition 4. What's that now? 6 months ago, Jesus. Which was, I believe, an extension of a chapter that was in Bitcoin is Venice.
Yeah. Yeah. Or not just a section. The chapters are quite long, but
a very slight
extension of a section to make it kind of stand alone.
Okay. So an extension of a section of a book in a publication. Beautiful. And this one, I remember it being, you know, nice, short, sharp, succinct. And I had a quick scan through
yesterday. It's very unusual for me.
Yeah,
so I had seriously. To clarify, it's not a whole chapter.
It's I haven't gone and read Bitcoin is Venice yet. I need to. I mean, I've read obviously all the essays and stuff like that. How has the turnout for the book been? Like the feedback and stuff?
Good question. I'm not actually entirely sure because Bitcoin Magazine are gonna tell us, I think we've agreed like every quarter they're gonna give us an update. On numbers, right? They did mention very, very soon after it was released, though, that I'm going to completely, it's probably not worth mentioning numbers because I really don't remember them. I remember my reaction to the email being like, oh, that seems pretty good. Because obviously they made like quite a big deal about it and Gladstein's one as well at the conference. Mm-hmm. And so they tried to like pump it as much as possible there. I mean, mm-hmm. I think it's gone pretty well. I don't have anything quantitative yet. Just my impression is people like it. That's nice. Very small set of people, but still.
Yeah, I wonder how much of a bubble we're still in. Like I was actually, when I was driving back from the gym today, I was thinking to myself, you know, what is the way in which Bitcoin literature kind of seeps into the rest of the world? I don't really know the answer to that because I think Bitcoin literature is really, really good, especially the well-written stuff, like, you know, a lot of the stuff that you write, et cetera. And I wonder how long it takes for that stuff to kind of seep in. Cause it seems like most of the people reading the stuff to each other.
I had kind of a sneaky guerrilla tactic in Miami to this effect, which as far as I can tell, hasn't paid off yet, but there was a handful of high profile people that I ensured I gave signed copies to. This will guilt them into reading it. And then hopefully they will like it. And then they will publicize it themselves because they are significantly more popular and also more generally appreciated than me. I wouldn't say who any of them are because none of them have done it yet, but I still have my fingers crossed.
Yeah, well, I think Mark Moss and I did the same thing with our one with the Uncommunist Manifesto. And we got it into the hands of, I think, probably the same list of people that you did.
Yes, all four of them.
Yeah, exactly.
That's why they haven't read any of them yet, because you're like, what the fuck is this stack of 20 Bitcoin books?
Exactly.
All signed.
All of us idiots thought we were like, we had a plan. We're like, I know, I'm going to do something that no one else has thought of. They've got the exact, yeah, okay, well, I mean, now we know. Well, speaking of the article for the Bitcoin Times, I wanted to start with the topic of toxic bigness. It was the first thing that I've got written here in my notes. And I wanted you to define it so that people have an understanding of the terminology, but then, able to be used outside of just the context of discussions inside Bitcoin circles, because I think it's kind of what I'm trying to do these days with the podcast is I'm trying to like create language so that people can speak to people outside of just Bitcoin. So talk me through toxic bigness.
With that as the intro, probably a few clarifications are necessary because this won't be the most helpful rhetoric in that respect. I mean, insofar as it is very rhetorical, it's not, I'm not referring to any kind of established ideas in politics or economics. I mean, it's something I think most Bitcoiners will understand just kind of intuitively. Like, I don't think they'll bat an eyelid at it. I don't think pre-coiners, I guess, if you want to call them that, will really respond to it at all. So it is worth clarifying that it's kind of a slur. I think it's a deserved slur, as we'll go on to talk about, but it's not like a scientific description of something. It's just me being a bit of a dick. So what is it? It's either business or government, or probably some weird unnatural intersection of the two, which is bigger than could possibly be sustained naturally without access to fiat money, which, to tee up a bunch of possible tangents, I don't know where you're going to want to take this, but
that's right.
I think that's what's interesting about that claim, even though it maybe seems simple enough, is that usually Bitcoiners talk about this in economic terms, just in, you know, like zombie companies, right? That, you know, this, that they shouldn't be capable of being financed. What I quite liked about this this extract that was that we kind of modified a little bit for the Bitcoin Times is that I'm not sure, I don't want to like pat myself on the back too much. I'm sure other people have talked about this, but I don't think I've come across anybody articulating it the way I did here, in that it also quite clearly, I think, applies to politics if you have, or like government, let's say, if you have the right lens. The lens being that with fiat, for the first time literally ever in history, there is no cost at all to creating more money. It's not just that there's a very low cost and like it might be worth it, as in like, you know, seizing power might be worth it because of all the wealth that you can then accrue. It's that there's literally no cost, which creates this kind of scary situation, I think, in that there is therefore no cost of trying to seize power that wouldn't be worth it, because you can pay yourself back and more. And so obviously that creates incentives for far, far greater, you know, governmental overreach, let's say, than is possible to sustain otherwise, which is kind of a, I was going to say it's a nice analog. It's not nice. It's a horrifying analog of what we're more used to thinking about just in regular business terms.
Sorry, I was muted. Yeah, that's a really, really good framing. I've been on a World War I and World War II rabbit hole recently, and I did William Shirer's Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, and I just finished. What was his name? It was an Englishman who wrote about World War I. And I want to do both sides of the story, right? Because most of World War I and World War II history is written by the victors. So I want to, my next goal is to read the background of the story. But it's interesting how World War I was such a big, Knut said this on my podcast last time, actually, we did episode 69 together, and he mentioned something interesting. He said, we're still in World War I effectively, like, but just it's morphed into something else, because that was kind of like a,
doesn't Safe have a line about this? I don't remember if it's a quote from maybe the Bitcoin Standard, or if it's just something he says a lot, that Bitcoin is the technology that will finally end World War I.
Yeah, maybe. There you go. So yeah. maybe Knut stole it from him. Who knows? We all seem to be stealing shit off each other, but,
there's only so many actual ideas.
I know.
There's like three, really.
And we're all just like molding them a little bit. I said that. So what's interesting is, to your point, there is no cost at the moment of attempting overreach, whereas kind of like World War I seems to have been that crossing the Rubicon moment, in the sense of prior to that, there was actually a calculus that needed to be done to try and, try and reach and grab power or grab territory or something. There was always going to be a cost of some sort. Whereas, you know, crossing that Rubicon kind of gave, and this is where I hesitate to say that, you know, everything's a conspiracy theory and that it's sort of some grand plan with lizards in the, you know, behind red curtains that are planning to do this, but it's kind of, it seems to me that in World War I, there was a realization, particularly the way technology and warfare adapted in those 4 years, that toward the end, like, you know, it went from manpower to, you know, to machine power, to artillery power and everything like that. But what happened was that the money printers really started to burr towards the end of the war. And that's really, I mean, Germany was actually more adept than the rest. And what happened was, you know, the Allies were able to throw enough monetary resources, because they had a large capital base to draw from. Alongside, obviously, they ended up with more numbers. So it was, I don't know, it's just really interesting that we went from a world with consequence for reach, and now we're kind of in a world absent of consequences for reach, or at least absence on the surface, right? We don't
know. I have a really interesting addition to that, by the way, which is something that I realized quite recently that I was disappointed. I'm pretty sure we don't mention in Bitcoin as Venice. We probably should have, because we whine about GDP a lot. I don't know if that's something you want to get onto. This might be much of a tangent, but, or at least for just now, but that GDP, in addition to everything else, every other way I can complain about it as a measure, people forget that it was literally invented, although I'm pretty sure, just historical note, it was invented in the lead up to World War II, not World War I, but the same point applies. It was invented as a measure of how many resources can be redirected towards total war. Mm-hmm. Which it is actually quite good at capturing, because it's basically saying, you know, what is, it's total consumption, right? It's total revenue. It's not profit and it's not returns, and it tells you nothing about the capital base. But actually, in total war, that might be one of the only circumstances where it is rational to care. I wouldn't say not care at all, but care significantly less about preserving your capital and significantly more about spending a lot right now. Because you have to win, right? If you lose, it doesn't matter what your returns are. Your returns are zero, basically, if you lose. So I'm not trying to, like, you know, obviously defend militarism or globalism or anything like that. But with no moral judgment, I think it is fair to say it's rational to care about that. If you're in a position where you're deciding how to allocate these resources and you want to not lose a total war, GDP is a relevant number. In no other context is it a relevant number.
Mm-hmm. So I guess GDP basically emerged between World War I and World War II, right? As a measurement.
I'm pretty sure it was in the lead up to World War II. And I think it was a British economist, I want to say, or maybe a statistician or someone, or maybe an American one. I forget exactly. So someone can fact check this afterwards, but I do know that that's why it was created. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, Are you aware of what was originally in the basket to measure GDP?
I'm not sure that anyone really talked. I mean, I'm just making this up now. The straightforward answer is I don't know. But I suspect it's actually more interesting, like, oh, it was some better measure. I think it was probably literally nothing. I don't think people thought that way. And maybe this is a good link exactly back to your point about this transition with World War One, that prior to the monetary changes that enabled that military transition, it wouldn't ever have been relevant to think about how much, you know, there would have been consequences, right? To diverting absolutely every resource you have to war. Like, you wouldn't have been able to think that way. It's only once you are, maybe this is why it was after World War One that people started thinking this way, right? That only once you are able to literally turn everything towards war. And again, there's subtle here. I know that you know this anyway, but it's not that there's no consequences. It's that you can kind of cheat yourself out of realizing the consequences immediately. But once you can do that, does GDP start to be something that's useful to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the cheating of consequences. So I'm writing a piece now called Bitcoin Shows You, It Doesn't Tell You.
That might be a new idea.
It's basically the same idea.
That's the fourth idea.
Right? Yeah. Yeah, the fourth idea. I finally found it. No, but seriously, the premise of the idea is the idea that I should say idea another six times. The premise here is that in the fiat world, it seems to me that everything is like talk or decree, right? I mean, the very word fiat or decree is, you know, we're going to tell you that there's no inflation. We're going to tell you what the interest rate is.
Yeah.
We're going to tell you this. We're going to tell you that. Whereas in Bitcoin land, there's no telling. It's just, perform the action. Like, and the example I use in the article is, if you don't believe me, try and send a Bitcoin payment to an incompatible address and then call up Bitcoin support, you know, and see if they're going to give you your money back for making a mistake. Like, there's no decree in the land of Bitcoin. It's a it's a thing that it shows you. And basically the underlying idea there is that, in my mind, Bitcoin's most important, I don't know, gift to human civilization is the reintroduction of consequence. And and maybe to adapt that to what you just said earlier, it's maybe that's not actually accurate. It's not the reintroduction of consequence. It's the reintroduction of the inability to lie to yourself about the consequences.
Yeah, yeah. I'd say something like, it's the fair allocation of consequence, right? It's, you will suffer your own consequences.
Yeah, okay. Yep.
You can't, to link it to what you gave as your introduction there, right? You can't tell other people what is the case and have them suffer the consequences of acting as if that's true, even though it's not. If you insist on acting as if there is some economic lie effectively at play that you want to be true, you will suffer from the, you know, the miscalculation that will follow, but you can't push that on anybody else.
Yeah. Yeah. So I guess then it's, I mean, there's the other word of responsibility that comes up. So it's like consequence and responsibility. So there's a, I mean, I'm sure you've read Man's Search for Meaning, right?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't think I've ever heard a Bitcoiner talk about that. That's a great book.
Really? Fuck, this is one of my favorite books. It's like,
it's amazing.
In the top five of books that I recommend all the time. So there's a line at the end of the book where Viktor Frankl says, in the same way as the East Coast has the Statue of Liberty, the West Coast should have a Statue of Responsibility, right? Because it's how you balance the equation. So, and I kind of had this epiphany when I was reading that. I was trying to think of a word that encompasses both freedom and responsibility. And I thought, like, independence kind of comes to mind. It's that.
Yeah, maybe.
It's kind of like,
I don't know. I kind of feel like there shouldn't be at the same time, right? It's useful that they're different. It sort of ruins Frankl's point if there is one, because then it just, the distinctions get lost.
True. Yeah. So exactly. There isn't a word that really encompasses them both, but I'm trying to think of, like, freedom bound by responsibility, I think, is the realm of morality in some sense. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, unhinged freedom is the ability for me to just slap you because I'm free to do so. But that doesn't take into account, you know, the I guess, for lack of a better term, the moral restriction of responsibility. It's like, I may be free to do something, I must be responsible not to.
In chapter 8, so this this extract is from chapter 9, which is the last chapter, but in chapter 8, which Sasha was the primary author on, I'm just mentioning that so that if I now butcher this explanation, I have an excuse. He goes into this in quite a lot of detail and in quite a lot of different contexts. And I think if I could maybe summarize all of them, but at a slightly higher level, it'd be something like, true freedom implies restraint.
Yeah. Yeah. Is that it?
Yeah, I was trying to be as concise as possible.
I was very concise. I was waiting for like an oration.
For another 10 minutes on that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I even muted my mic.
Or like, I got a little bit more. I think this is maybe going a bit away from what you had in mind that seemed more kind of economically grounded. Because I mean, the whole thing about chapter 8 is it's basically got nothing to do with economics. It's kind of taking these principles to wider social sphere. But something like, in order to really realize the what would you call it? In order to realize the extent of your own ability and fulfillment as an individual specifically, so I'm not kind of slipping into like collectivist agitprop here, or at least I'm not trying to, in order to realize your the extent of your ability and fulfillment as an individual, you simply must embrace community, but so must everybody else in that community. And they all must act in a way that is acknowledged to be free, but nonetheless restrains from harming others. And not just harm in like a criminal sense and like, you know, I can't slap you, but I think there's a softer reading as to how this affects culture as well.
Okay, elaborate. So
I'd rather Sasha do. just things like, I think, yeah, I was a bit wary of this because I know this is getting a bit away from sort of economics, which is where we started, and then politics to some extent too, but
doesn't matter.
I think it falls quite naturally out of thinking seriously about personal responsibility, but in a sense that is less than criminal. You know, like, how do you treat other people, for example? Like, how do you, or even something like, how do you engage in the production of culture? This is getting a little bit abstract, but I don't know, you might find it interesting anyway, right? That here's a good way you can link this, I think, without it being too strained to like something like modern art, in that if you're engaging the production of culture, you do want it to be, whatever you're producing, you want it to be original, right? Because otherwise, what's the point? Which is, that's the sense in which, you know, you need to be free to do something new. You need to embrace your own individuality. But you don't want it to be so removed from what anyone is capable of understanding that it's basically just narcissism, which is what I would argue. This is like kind of maybe an unhelpfully abstract way of criticizing modern art, when you can just say like, well, it's obviously shit. But, you know, I think this is also valid, right? That if you really try to take as seriously as possible the motivations of the people doing it, you still end up with this. Like, there's no excuse. I think this is like the nicest possible way of interpreting, I'll just say, bad art, right? You don't need to pick on any specific thing that you happen to dislike, but bad art tends to be either completely unoriginal, which is back to the first point, which is like you have nowhere near enough freedom in your expression, or you have so much freedom in your expression that what you've produced is like meaningless. So that's in the cultural sphere, for example. Mm-hmm. But I think it's the same kind of point, right? It's that in order to really embrace freedom, you need restraint.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a very interesting interplay. That thread, that golden thread of these kind of dualistic forces seems to be found everywhere, right? Like the whole chaos and order thing, the yin yang, like day and night. It seems to exist everywhere. It's there seems to me that there is no escape from that. I don't know if I should call it duality or complementary nature of of the universe, which is, yeah, we're getting very metaphysical here, but
I think that's fair though. I mean, I'm not sure I'd even describe that as metaphysical necessarily. I think everything, at least that we've talked about so far, that fits this really just falls out of healthy social relations. This will be true whenever there is more than one person, basically. And it's ultimately a kind of what it falls out of is, I guess you could say, something like respect, right? Like if you're not a solipsist, if you acknowledge that other people are different to you, then you can't just get what you want, right? You can't be maximally free, because that will infringe on whether it's, you know, something kind of more, I guess, like line in the sand ethical about, you know, you're infringing on their natural rights or something like that, or just as like borderline jokey as well, as like, oh, but you're just producing shit art. Like, why are you doing that? Stop. But I think that's where it comes from. And actually, you can maybe even drive that further to get back to where we started by suggesting that you need to appreciate that in order to understand subjective value in economics in the first place, right? Subjective value emerges from the existence of different minds, which again, that is a bit more metaphysical and a bit more abstract than the way people usually put it. But, you know, to link it to culture, why not? I think it's still valid.
So then I want to tie this into a piece or a question that I've got here about globalism and transnationalism. So where does, in your mind, globalism and this transnationalism push kind of fit on that spectrum of
That's
responsibility and respect.
That's really fascinating. The first thing I'd say is I really don't like using the word globalism because it is almost unavoidably interpreted as an insult. And this is an interesting contrast to when we were talking about the rhetoric of toxic bigness, where I kind of mean it as an insult, like I want to be edgy. Here, I very much don't want to be edgy because I think there is a phenomenon worth identifying and analyzing soberly without gratuitously insulting people, just so that they take you seriously, right? So, because I think a lot of the time, if you say, and you mentioned this before too, I forget, it was in a different context, but that, you know, you don't want it to come across as conspiratorial and like lizard men and Bond villains and all that, which is why I prefer transnationalism, which I think means the same thing, but just isn't an insult. And yeah, so the link to kind of respect and responsibility, I mean, there's probably quite a lot. I'll keep it to two, I guess. We can focus conversation a little bit more. You can maybe think of others and go off on another tangent, I guess. But one would be the link to toxic bigness in the first place, that I don't think it's even possible. I think it's I think the kind of transnationalism that is common today is basically impossible without fiat. I don't think there's a historical precedent for it. And that alone ought to worry you, provided you already buy that the toxic bigness that emerges from fiat is unnatural. I think it doesn't necessarily mean that transnationalism is bad, but it ought to at the very least make you suspicious that, you know, why is this only really emerged now or very recently in historical terms, that like that ought to be probed more. Whereas the people who promote it or even just kind of blithely accept it, I think are like, oh, but it's obviously good. So like, yeah, I don't want to straw man it, but it doesn't matter that it's never existed before because it's an innovation and it's a good innovation. So like, don't complain. Something along those lines, I think is maybe what they would say. So, yeah, one is the connection to toxic bigness. Sorry, do you want to jump in?
Oh, I was going to say, don't they usually justify it with the emergence of technology that connects us all?
Something like that. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Anyway, so I'll
shut
up.
Which is very lazy though, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, why didn't it emerge when, you know, 100 years after the printing press, say? Like, why there's like no analog to it whatsoever in that period of time? Maybe that's not a rabbit hole worth going down. But the second one, though, is this is where I think you can be a bit more forceful, is that it's necessarily, I guess, overriding localism, which, again, I want to be careful because I don't want to just say localism in such a way that it has such overwhelmingly positive connotations that people are like, oh, that's great. So anything opposing that is bad. But if you dig into what we mean by that a bit more, I think basically what I mean is what would be natural were it not for toxic bigness in the first place, right? Where things get as big as they actually efficiently can before they're, you know, I don't know, this will mean different things in different contexts, but something like, you know, before their marginal returns start to go negative, right? Like they get to the size that it's actually healthy for them to be, and they're not artificially propped up, whether as businesses or states or whatever. This is begging the question a little bit, but I think in kind of a fair way, I suppose, in that it to my mind, it almost follows by definition that just is healthier. It's like what we're talking about here is removing something that's unhealthy. What is left over doesn't mean it's perfect, but it's certainly healthier than these malign incentives that we have now. And so when you view a kind of a transnationalist political attitude, at least, and it has economic components as well, when you view it in that context, you can only really see it as aggressively opposing localism and destroying local knowledge, or at the very least ignoring local knowledge and just kind of homogenizing everything into what the best way to describe it would be, something like, you know, an entirely generalized consumerist marketplace that doesn't respect any of the cultures on which it is actually imposed and from which it has actually emerged, something like that.
Can we quickly define localism? Because I have a thread here that I want to tie it into. How do you define?
I kind of caught myself even when I was describing it there, because I'm not sure that I have that well thought out a definition of it. I actually think of it kind of in a negative sense, or like I frame it in a negative sense, instinctively at least, which is, you know, not what we have now. But I guess it would just be something like, to the greatest extent possible and natural too, because I guess you could go too far in this direction, or you could propose going like unhealthily far in this direction. Actually, come to think of it, I think it means completely different things in the political and economic sphere. So in the political sphere, it means that decisions and political authority, or decisions are made and political authority is held as locally and on as small a scale as possible. For I think quite important reasons that are I guess sort of grounded in maybe even psychology. I'm trying to think of the best way to frame that, or certainly some element of social relations, in that people just behave differently in smaller groups than in much, much, much larger groups. And, you know, and that behavior doesn't scale effectively, which is kind of like a wanky, almost techie way of saying it. But as in, you know, if you have
sound a group like of 10
people, they will, yeah. If you have a group of 10 people, they will behave in a way that is completely unrecognizable from a group of 1,000 or 1,000,000 people. It's not like it's just the same thing, but 10 times, 100 times bigger, right? And maybe this is a bit too much to get into now, but I would suggest that behavior is far, basically better. It's more moral, it's more considerate, it's more, maybe to tie it to what we were talking about before, it's more restrained, it's less concerned with aggressively maximizing individual freedom to others' costs. Basically, I think, because people actually know each other and they care about each other, and it's, you know, they're incentivized on a personal level to collectively achieve good governance rather than having to engage with something that is toxically big, right? Where they basically don't feel like they have any stake in it, and they may as well just maximize their own gain. Something like that. So that's in the political realm. And then in the economic realm, I don't think it's quite as dramatic. It's basically like you should be more, there's a literal sense in which, you know, like production should be more local. It should be less kind of strewn all over the globe. I think the more important point though is that that's veering into like a weirdly moral judgment, which I tend to find is kind of unhelpful if you're making an economic point. I think the economic point is that will likely lead to far more robust production rather than things like just-in-time supply chains. Or again, linking about, maybe there's an overlap with the politics as well, where because of the toxic bigness of fiat, everything is outrageously leveraged and it can't survive any shocks at all.
It's, as you were talking there, I just had this interesting epiphany, which is, and again, it's probably not an epiphany, but you mentioned in smaller, more local, I guess, societies, let's just use that word, because people are in closer proximity or they know each other, the I guess the need for restraint or responsibility or respect, the three R's, is heightened because of, you know, potential social vilification or whatever. But in large numbers, it seems to me that freedom is maximized at the expense of respect, et cetera, respect, restraint, responsibility. But because you end up with these strange outliers in a large scale system like that, then what has to happen in order to normalize or to manage these large scale, you know, globalist or transnational sort of political systems, then you have to kind of necessarily try and chop freedoms in order to, I guess, to manage the system, you know, to kind of like almost enforce a strange version of responsibility. So it's not even responsibility.
Right.
You see what kind of where I'm getting at?
Yeah. Yeah.
So what happens naturally in a local sense is kind of artificially enforced in a globalist sense.
Yeah. 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 No, definitely. And just if listeners are interested in this, I was just checking just now quickly because I couldn't remember whether this quote was in this extract or not, but it's not in this extract. There's a couple of quotes very shortly afterwards where this extract comes in the book from a book called The Breakdown of Nations by Leopold Kohr, which I highly, highly recommend. And pretty much most of what I've said in the last 10 minutes is like trying to remember what he said. And actually also the point you just made is in that book as well.
I'm taking notes now. So The Breakdown of Nations, Leopold, what was his name?
Leopold for Leopold, and then Kohr is Kohr.
Okay, interesting. Fuck, there's always such a wealth of knowledge when it comes to books from you, man. Honestly, you're like one of the people who I look out for when it comes to books.
I guess stop recommending them if you want. Or like, well, is a really short book. I was going to say I can only recommend really short books.
No, this is fantastic.
It has, I'm not sure if I want to spoil this. All right, you can edit this out, podcast, if you think this is too much of a spoiler. It has the funniest chapter of any book I've ever read. It's quite near, I forget what number it is, but it's quite near the end. And he's done like a very thorough, but also not too long analysis of this idea that basically nations should be a lot smaller. It's very similar to what we've just been talking about. And he approaches it with, or at least towards the end, he starts approaching it by kind of playing his own devil's advocate, and that the titles of the chapters become proposed problems with this. So like, oh, but what about this? But what about this? And then in the chapter, he says, no, that would actually be fine, right? But then he gets to this chapter where the title is, but will it happen? And then the entire chapter is just the word, no.
Classic. When was this book written? I'm curious. I've never heard of this book.
Good question. I want to say the 70s. I have the Wikipedia page open though, so let me just check.
Okay.
Oh, no, it was earlier than that. It's 1957.
Yeah, wow. Okay. Man, some powerful literature from that period of history, particularly earlier than that. So, okay, there's while we're on the topic of localism, there's something that I wanted to tie it into, which is culture, right? And to me, one way I've tried to come to grips with localism is through the lens of culture. It seems to me that culture kind of emerges, like, you know, I mean, there's a relationship between the word cult and culture, right? So it's kind of this thing that comes about as a result of people's proximity and relationship with sort of people that they know, and, you know, these sort of norms develop. And I guess when you begin to strip localism away and move down, you know, the spectrum of kind of this transnationalism and globalism, you basically erode all of the diverse variations of culture that naturally exist in a local fashion. And I know they seem to kind of, I said this on a prior podcast, I think a few episodes ago, I don't know if it was mine or someone else's podcast, but when I first went to Bali, right, the most packed out restaurant that I saw there at the airport was fucking McDonald's. And it was painful to watch. I was like, man, you flew all the way to Indonesia to come and eat McDonald's? Like, what's wrong with you people? And
Bali's not really Indonesia though. Come on, be honest.
Well, but Bali's an example of something that has been, you know, like the culture's gone, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And it's just been kind of in.
It's funny. I only know this because I'm part of the problem. I went there and I was like, I was realizing this is going to make perfect sense to some of your listeners and no sense whatsoever to others because of localism. Interestingly enough, as soon as I got there, I was like, holy shit, this is like Ibiza, but for Australians.
Yeah, basically. It's Costa Rica for Australia.
Actually, sorry,
that's what I've called it in the past.
I need to correct myself for the few locally minded people who might have been offended by that. Ibiza is actually really nice. It's just the one tiny corner of it. It's like Magaluf for Australians.
megalith. I don't even know what the hell that is. Is that
because it's super low. It's a tiny little part of Portugal that's just like a British colony, but for drunk teenagers.
Yeah, well, it seems like there's one of those in basically every segment of the world, right? Like Costa Rica is literally the South American example of where, you know, all the Americans go and do their thing. So I guess, you know, the richness in culture emerges from these kind of local bonds or these local connections, which we seem to lose when we move down, down the path of transnationalism. So, I mean, I don't know, do you have any comments on that, on the link between culture and localism?
It's worse. It's more insidious than the way you described it there, because I think, again, following from this only emerges in the first place from toxic bigness, or at least seems to, transnationalism is almost always imposed. It doesn't emerge organically. It has to be sort of artificially subsidized and sort of politically imposed in kind of a top-down or centralized, or, you know, whatever your preferred metaphor for this is, way, which makes it inherently fragile. What I mean by that, and the reason I think that, is that it's more kind of framing it in the negative in contrast to localism. I think local culture, the way you described it, has intrinsic virtue beyond just what you might call a kind of a romantic appreciation for it, which I think is, this is important to emphasize, because not that there's anything wrong with that, but I think people can there's a very obvious danger of just slipping into a almost like borderline chauvinistic, you know, oh, isn't that so cute? Don't let them develop kind of thing, right? So that's very much not what I mean. I think it has intrinsic merit because it reflects the evolution of processes that work. And you don't even need to necessarily know why they work, but you can trust to some extent, maybe not to a full extent, you shouldn't just blindly believe in it, but you can trust to some extent that whatever these processes are there for a reason. And I guess maybe return to being a bit romantic about it, promote human flourishing in some or other way, maybe a very misguided way. I don't know, but it, you know, they're not, it's kind of like Chesterton's fence, really. That's what I'm getting to with this, right? That if you want to remove these things, which you're necessarily doing if you're imposing some kind of transnationalist credo, you should at the very least understand why they are there, which almost never happens in what, like, the, you know, the people who put the McDonald's in Bali did not care about what they were replacing, for example.
Yeah, that's such a, yeah, that's such a good point, because then that basically ties back into why Bitcoin fundamentally seems to move us towards localism, because on a Bitcoin standard, it becomes very expensive. Once again, this ties back into the opposite to toxic bigness, which we opened up with. There is a consequence to now reaching and kind of imposing your version of the world onto other cultures, other localities, and stuff like that. So I guess I want to tie off this localism piece with this idea that I've been kind of thinking about for a number of years now, is that Bitcoin kind of is kind of like a blend of localism and globalism, in the sense that it's like, it enables.
Well, can I interrupt very quickly? So the chapter that this extract is from is called Global Money, Local Freedom.
Beautiful. Okay. Well, this is perfect then. So you'll be able to elaborate on this. Is my note here is that Bitcoin enables localism with global interconnectedness. So maybe you can talk us through that.
I'm not sure this is even all that complicated. I think we've covered the localism part, right? The global part, I think the connection you want to make is something like, for all the local heterogeneity, economic value is homogeneous. I'm not sure if that's exactly right, but like, the way, this is a better way of putting it, the way that people arrive at value in economic terms, not at all in cultural terms, but in economic terms, is the same everywhere. And hence, it's ideally helpful, at least in terms of facilitating trade more effectively, but again, trade that they actually want, not that's just been imposed on them, for them to have the same monetary system, monetary standard, because they all value their time in the same way. That's ultimately what it comes down to, right? If you, I think maybe an interesting kind of a tragic comparison to this would be something like, if you just compare, I don't know, just pick any two countries where one of the where neighboring countries where one of them is experiencing hyperinflation, right? They, and I'm saying neighboring on purpose so that you can maybe assume, I don't have a good example of this, unfortunately. You can maybe think of one, but you can assume that they're not too culturally different. But you see that their economic behaviors end up being wildly different because they can't sort of conceive of time in the same way, or in the way that they should. You know, maybe for the sake of argument, one of them can, but the other one can't because they're forced onto the, you know, the hamster wheel of debt and whatever else. So I think that's how you make the connection to globalism, that valuing time is a, or ought to be a global phenomenon, or like a maybe even global, like that's kind of an unhelpful way of putting it. It's a universal phenomenon. Every person and every group of people does this the same way. And it's probably one of the only things that they do the same way. So maybe leave the rest of their culture alone.
Mm-hmm. So what do you think, to kind of put a, to tie a bow on this segment, is what do you think emerges, like, without falling into the trap of, you know, talking about utopian panaceas? It's like, you know, we're going to live in this amazing world where
citadels everywhere.
Yeah, basically. Like, how do you think, obviously we're going to be wrong in our presumptions on this, or we may be, you know, elements of what we predict or think about might be right, but what's your interpretation of how this looks 1500 years from now?
So I have one answer to this that I think is really simple, which is just companies are smaller. Maybe even states are smaller too. So that's Core's whole argument, right? There should be many more smaller states. I think that's a bit trickier because you do get into like where we started with this, right? Like state violence and war, and like there's more variables there. I think just for economics though, you just have much smaller businesses and you have real competition and you have differences not only in the businesses but in the nature of the competition between businesses in different localities.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I do want to push you on the state pieces. Do you not think states necessarily start to function a little bit more like?
Oh, I do. No, I definitely do. I wasn't meaning to dismiss that. I just meant that I think that's a far more complicated question than I do for economics.
Yeah. Okay.
I feel like I've got a good answer for economics. I'm not quite so sure of politics.
Thank you for listening to the Wake Up Podcast. Find us on the Fountain app and send us a boost with a comment. I'll try and read them in tweet and send you a shout out. And remember to grab a copy of the Uncommunist Manifesto and join us in defeating the plague that is consuming our world.